Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Collazo, joined by special guest, Editor-in-Chief, JJ Cooper. What's up, JJ?
Hey, Carlos. Long time no talk.
Yeah, it is very cool to have you on the Draft Pod. I actually don't know how often we've had you Podcast specifically, so that feels like an error on my end.
You've got enough. There's enough people to do this that you do not need me. I think the last time I was on is I hosted the mock draft where we went 40 picks deep right before last year's draft.
Okay. That's my last appearance. Well, that's a good one. Well, I wanted to have you on to kind of get your insight into this draft class. You also wrote a story this week that I feel like is very relevant to the draft and maybe could be instructive in how teams are evaluating prospects or evaluating timelines. We'll get into that in the next segment, but first I wanted to just kind of get your sense of the draft class, because people who have listened to this draft pod have heard what I think about the draft. They've heard what Jacob thinks about the draft. I'm sure people who are listening to this draft podcast also listen to future projections. I mean, Ben, I've been talking about this class for a while, but I know you've been watching a lot of college baseball over the last 2 weeks. You've had conversations with scouts about this class, and you've expressed your excitement about this class to me offline. So like, what is your sense of the 2026 class, a group that was billed very positively, came into the year with great reviews based on our scouting director feedback and our preseason poll? What are your just overall thoughts on the class at this stage from where you sit?
I get really excited any year that we have, and I feel like this is one of those rare years where you come into the season and you have someone who you're like, wow, this could really be one of those years. Now, not every one of those years does that end up coming true that way, but most of the time it does, right? Like in my time at BA, the ones that kind of come to mind this way, obviously I think it starts with it's Strasburg and Harper, right? Where in both of those cases, you had someone coming in, it's like, this is the guy, this is the number one prospect. And then the dust cleared and it was like, yeah, this guy's the number one prospect. And again, you have to have that. The GM usually always has to have that. We're looking at all the options. We're keeping our eyes open, you know, and all that. But those are so much more enjoyable than the flip side is like the Matt Bush year, which ended up, by the way, Justin Verlander was in that class. Mm-hmm. But that was the year where it's like the Padres are like, our options, or we're looking at this. And then they got to the very end and was like, ah, we'll take Matt Bush. He's close. He's right nearby. He wants to play here. You know, all that. And you're like, wow, that was kind of underwhelming. Those two obviously come to mind. We always talk, you and I have talked about it, because this was true. This was one that we covered together looking back, is like the Adley Rutschman year, which ended up being, now we could call it the Bobby Witt Jr. year. And oh yeah, by the way, Adley went one. But the Adley Rutschman year, where it's like you had this college catcher who was extremely athletic, who was extremely productive, and came in kind of, even with the high school shortstops, it's like, this is as comfortable a top prospect as you get. Mm-hmm. I feel like, and I want to do a little mea culpa that I could get away with not doing, because I've only said it in conversations with people like you and not like publicly, but I'll own it anyway, which is, I got to be honest though, I came into the season a little bit with a little bit of Rochelowski skepticism, not like, oh, this guy's not a good prospect or anything like that, but some skepticism of college shortstop is not normally the profile that produces big league stars. You have to go back, I would say, to at the top of the draft, right? I'm not saying that there aren't any college shortstops who end up being stars, but if you look at it, no, I mean, the most of the best shortstops in the big leagues, this is not their path, right? We did have the Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman year, which is more than a decade ago now. Right, we had Trey Turner.
Yep.
But those are, you know, if you said who have been the most productive shortstops of the last 10, 15 years, I would say that you would have to throw Francisco Lindor. You would have to throw Corey Seager. You would have to throw Carlos Correa's in there. And all there's more high school. There's more international, mainly high school, I'd say. But there's more other paths than there are the college, largely because usually the best shortstops don't get to college. Right.
Exactly.
And when they do, even when they do, like Matt McClain was one who was a first round pick coming out of high school, got to college. comes out and he's still a first round pick, but it's like, okay, again, it's still something where they're a little bit more limited. Brooks Lee, you know, is a little bit more limited. This is a mea culpa though, because you watch Rokoslowski and you're like, woo.
So kind of drilling into this, when you mention it, it's interesting to hear. Were your reservations with Rock purely from that kind of demographic standpoint? Was there anything in the profile that you were like, yeah, I don't know about this aspect of his game? Or was it purely like, we don't see it this often, and so because of that, I want to see it a little bit more, because I think that makes both of those could make some sense. I think there are some cracks in Rock's game, but it's hard for those to surface at this point when we're 2 weeks into the season. He hasn't really faced, well, to be fair, they played TCU. A TCU team and he looked good. But I always like to like take a few weeks, let the hitters get some time. And we see it every year. There are players who go off before conference play in particular starts, and then they start to fade a little bit down the stretch. So I always like to be patient, but I'm curious if there's anything in his game outside of the demographic question that you mentioned.
The demographic, and the other thing I would say, and this is I would say this is nitpicking the number one prospect in the game. The questions are, I had a little bit of questions, and we still have to have a little bit of these, but hit tool with a wood bat, right?
Right.
He has a very limited track record. Like, we have the Cape, didn't really hit. And then we have USA Baseball last year. And let's just be clear, very few of those guys hit. It's a very short season.
The whole team didn't hit.
but he did not hit. And right. If you said, and we had guys who were out there more than I do, I want to make clear. But if you said, and talking to evaluators who were out there, it's like, if you said, who was the best hitter on that college national team last year, best pure hitter, I've heard coming into this year's class a little bit more of maybe Drew Burris is the best pure hitter in this class more than Rock. Now, that is, Drew Burris is one of the top prospects in this class. Rokoslowski is a what you look for, how they build them, shortstop, as opposed this is a little bit unconventional outfielder.
Right.
But those are like, again, if you said where I kind of came in a little bit, like I would say, you know, I had a conversation with you after you saw Emerson, and I was kind of asking about Grady Emerson. Like, that just feels like kind of like could be the kind of guy that is a number one prospect. And then I'm looking at that now and I'm going, okay, Rokoslowski's a number one prospect. I don't think that that's going to change all year. I would be, again, we want to be patient. We will let the draft come. We will not prejudge. But yeah. I do feel like that's something where I love to have ideas and then try to challenge them and then try to see where it goes.
Right.
And this is one where I'm like, I had a hypothesis and I feel like that already I'm like abandoning that hypothesis.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like the top player just kind of gets into that spot and then cruises the entire year. And this does feel more like a 2019 sort of draft class to me. And I think you made this point pretty consistently throughout the 2019 cycle, that class. We talked about it a lot, but that class got critiqued because the depth wasn't good. And I think you always came back and said, the depth is overrated. What you really need to separate a draft class is impact talent at the top. And I feel like this 2026 group has a sort of quasi-generational college prospect at a premium position at the top in Rokoslowski, who does feel a little bit Adley Rutschman-esque in the sense of like where he's at in terms of a tier of his own in the class. But beyond him, there's also a group of players that's really talented. We maybe don't have a Bobby Witt Jr. in this class like we did in 2019, right behind Adley Rutschman. But I think the top 15 or so of this class is really talented. But circling back to maybe one of Rock's flaws, I think what like I have kind of gone into this season wondering about and hoping to see him sort of solidify and improve is, I think because he is a different sort of shortstop prospect, I found myself comparing him to the sort of contact skills and the pure hitting ability that guys from the 2024 class like JJ Weatherholt and Travis Bazzana had offensively. I'm not sure that Rock ever will be that sort of contact hitter, but I think because of the power he provides, because of the defensive ability he provides, he's in another league compared to Weatherholt and Travis Bazzana at the same time in terms of what he can do defensively. I just ultimately don't know that that's going to matter. And we're seeing it play out early this year. And I guess at the end of the year, I'll really be curious in like, what is the overall contact rate look like and the zone contact rate in particular? Because Rock has been a player in the past who's chased a little bit, but I also think we've just seen him evolve year by year as an offensive hitter that I'm not really concerned about any aspect of his game at this stage.
Can I go back to the 100 point? Like, I stand with the idea that like when you hear about depth in a class, I would say if you have a great top of your class, like I think it is easy to overrate how much there's going to be in a class, right?
Yep.
And I'll give a perfect example of this, I feel like let's go from the worst case to the best, right? There is no first round pick, top 30 pick from the 2016 draft who has produced 10 war, B war yet so far. Now, that doesn't mean it won't happen. I would say that you could say that maybe Cole Reagans, who's at like 7.5, gets there. Maybe Gavin Lux kind of edges over that. But to be honest, most of these guys, they're never getting there, right? So that's 0 for 30. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't big leaguers. That doesn't mean that there aren't guys. And I just did a study about the top 100, and I want to emphasize to people, if you draft a first rounder and get 5 war out of them, that's not a terrible result.
One thing that's been clear to me as we've done the redrafts we've done in the past few years is how quickly you get beyond the everyday regulars and get into, hey, these are good relievers who are going in the first round on a redraft because they're productive relievers. Like, I definitely think people's expectations for what a success in the draft is, and especially what a success in the first round is, are far, far too high.
I would say in normal, they're about 4 times too high. They think, we got a guy who made 3 war. That's terrible. It's like, actually, that's probably top 50 to 60% in a normal class. Like, I always love to use the example. There's literally, and I'm going to blank on which year it is, it's the Billy Rowell draft, like 07, I think, that literally Tommy Pham is the only productive drafted and signed high school hitter in the entire class. And I apologize, Travis Snyder. If you want to argue Travis Snyder, feel free. That's it. We're done. Like, if you want to argue anyone else, it's Hank Conger. And Hank Conger was a good catcher, but not like a bat. That is the entirety of the class as far as productive hitters.
That's the 2006 class, I believe.
Yes.
Because 2007 was Jason Hayward.
No, 2006.
Sorry. 2006 was the pitcher draft. Yeah.
And so, but to give the example, so I said there was 0 10 war players so far in 2016. 2019, which obviously we have fewer years, right? 4 of the top 6 picks are already at 10 war. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, Bobby Witt's over 20, Adley Rutschman's over 15, Riley Green and CJ Abrams are over 10. And then if you go beyond that, Bryson Stott's at 10, Corbin Carroll's at 15, Anthony Volpe's at 8, he'll get there. George Kirby's at 8, he'll get there. Shea Langeliers is at 8, basically, he'll get there. Nick Lodolo's at 8.5. He'll probably get there. That's
the 2019 draft is so refreshing to me because I feel like there is, and I saw this in some replies to a story you did about Connor Griffin. I feel like there is sometimes this mentality that scouting has gotten worse because you can pick out some drafts that just haven't panned out. But all those 2019 names are guys that were there as the top. Like Bobby Wood Jr. was the number 2 prospect consensus in the class. Adley Rutschman was there. Corbin Carroll, top 15 prospect. Riley Green in that top tier. CJ Abrams in that top tier. Bryson Stott, like at the top. Nick, like it's just nice to see, because we see failure in the draft so often. Well, it's nice to see a draft where you're like, all the guys at the top, those are all the guys we had at the top at the time.
I'll also say though, so that's 2019, right? Mm-hmm. I will throw another hypothesis that I haven't fully developed out, but I believe it's a theory. Our real problem is if you look at it, it's the 2020, 2021, 2022 drafts more than anything. And if you say, why are those were the hardest drafts because it's an entire lost 2020 season, basically. Mm-hmm. If you say, wow, that 2020 draft, there's just some real misses at the top of that draft. And I would 100% agree with you that a draft that had Spencer Torkelson, Heston Kjerstad, Max Meyer, Asa Lacy, Austin Martin, Emerson Hancock, Nick Gonzalez, Robert Hassel, Zach Veen, Reed Detmers as your top 10. That's not how you'd line it up now. Mm-hmm. But that actually, I would say, makes an argument for why you need the totality of the story, right? You didn't have it that year. You didn't have it where you could actually evaluate these players over the course of their full amateur careers because there was a roadblock. And even when you go to 21, I would say, you know, that's the Henry Davis, Jack Leiter, Jackson Jobe, Marcelo Meyer, Colton Cowser class. That's still like there's this big gap, right? Because you are building out the story of these players. Mm-hmm. I would say that even stretches into 22. By 23, it really isn't, right? Teams are not even there's a no college player who was basically a top prospect who was in college in 2020. Those guys were largely like you got to see them in 21, 22, and then 23. The high school class, you really hadn't even, I would argue, kind of evaluated that group at that point.
Right.
And that's Paul Skeens, Dylan Cruz, Max Clark, Wyatt Langford, Walker Jenkins, Jacob Wilson, Rhett Lauder. You know, like that's more of what we're, again, talking about, where you're like, okay, I know we're still early enough that we haven't seen what Walker Jenkins is going to do in the big leagues. We haven't seen Max Clark. But you feel, you know, obviously, Paul Skeens went one. We feel pretty good about that one right now. But you feel much better about that. And I would say it is a perfect example of how you need, like, if you lose, you can have some data, right? Mm-hmm. You can have, like, here's what his workout was like. But not getting the data and the evaluations from a full season.
And just the performance, yeah.
And the performance. Think about, like, right now. Like, right now as we speak, when we look at this class, you asked about this class. So much is changing. And we're not trying to go overboard and react too quickly. We have Cameron Flueke as the top pitcher on our board right now. And Cameron Flueke did not pitch in fall ball, basically has made one start, and then now he's going to miss, it looks like, hopefully only half the season with a rib, you know, rib injury. I can tell you right now, I promise you this, not, you know, I'm not speaking, you are much more in charge of how we order this up. I can promise you the next time we update it, Cam Flueke is not going to be our top pitcher on the board.
Yeah,
because we have other pitchers who are, while we have no idea with Cam Flueke what he's going to be looking like until he gets back on the mound, we have other pitchers like Jackson Flora and all where you're like, we're seeing it. You know, we know what he's doing. And so the board moves so much as the season goes along.
Yeah, because I think even like even if you just look to see how much the season matters, you can almost just look at like how often are players moving on our updates. We do them basically monthly once the season starts to get rolling. And if you've only ever looked at like the top 100 updates, you might think that the draft ranking updates are kind of extreme in the sort of movement that you get up and down the board. But I just do think that is part of the process of the draft. There's so much uncertainty at this stage and players are changing so rapidly and we have to constantly be updating our priors and what we think about players and just like seeing, hey, this pitcher is throwing an entirely new pitch. There's a new velocity threshold this player has reached. This player is playing a new position. Oh, and he's also not hitting now. How does that impact how we're evaluating this player? So the constant feedback loop, it definitely leads to lots of change throughout the spring. And to your point, like there's just a lot you have to kind of track and follow that makes the board hopefully better. And for that 2020 class, we basically got none of that. We got, I think, 4 weeks of the college season. So,
I mean, like I'm sitting there and if you look, right, like if you look at old list for us and you say, okay, like when we were at the very start, like there are guys who didn't change much. Like if you look at an old list and then there are other guys who you're like, oh, like, I mean, to take a perfect example of this, if you go back to our 2019 list, that was a high school, you know, Spencer Jones was in high school at that time. And Spencer Jones started that year as a top 30 pick, I believe as a pitcher, and then kind of slid down the board because he got hurt. And so he slid kind of the back of 100. Yep. The flip side of that is that like JJ Blade was the back of the list at the start of that year and ended up in the top 10. Now, you know, he's ended up being an okay, you know, I wouldn't say he's been, but Kyle Stowers started that year at 30 and ended up at 100. Like, so, you know, like there is a lot of movement that happens in season. And again, both ways, like there are guys who that we could absolutely kind of throw the question out now and say, you know, like, why did we move that guy on? Or there are guys just like, wow, I'm really glad we moved that guy on. But, right. Okay, 2019 is a perfect example. Like the guy who ended up, sometimes I kind of look back at this and sometimes I do think that the guys who move so much in season, that's probably where there are more misses. Hunter Bishop was not in our initial top 100 that year and he ended up top 10.
So you're saying be wary of those players.
Be wary of them. If you look at, like, again, we are now far enough away, right? Mm-hmm. And if you said, who are the guys who really flew up the board? 2019, there's another guy who stands out for that. There was out in California, there was a freshman, Marcelo Meyer. Oh. And then there was a senior, Keone Kavako. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
And he went from off the board to a first round pick. Mm-hmm. And I would say, to go back to what we're saying here,
JJ's selling, like, his Steel Hall stock, I guess, after that. Here's a reclass. I'm not sure if that factors
reclass into this. I do think kind of changes it, but like, if you do look at some of these guys who, like, okay, the biggest pop up who didn't like fly up the board, he ended up, I believe, at 73, but Yordis Valdez was a guy who popped up that year, right? Like Hunter Barco kind of moved up a little bit during the season. Like, you know, I would say the guys who have the biggest movement in season, not that there's no success stories there, but I do think that there is something instructive that often you can talk yourself into a good year and then, you know, the tools and all that, but you have less of a pop-up guy. You have less of that track record with
less of a resume. Yeah.
Where you can get frustrated with the lack of improvement with a guy who's just been good for years. And you're like,
yeah. And there are some teams that in their models, they factor in track record and length of performance history pretty heavily and just are much less willing to take these sort of pop-up types, certainly in priority places on the board. Like Xavier Isaac is maybe a notable pop-up example who went in the first round. There are some teams who, like, no matter what their evals would have been in the spring, they just wouldn't have taken him in that range because their track record of history on the player didn't warrant them taking there. They just, like, philosophically would have been against doing that. So I do think it's interesting to think through how different teams handle those players. And what's also maybe interesting to think through and maybe pivot to is a story you wrote this week, JJ, on the site. I think you've been on top of this for a number of different stories, but you have another one this week. Five reasons why MLB prospects are getting to the majors faster than ever. You kind of took a look at how this is tracking for hitters, pitchers, college players, high school players,
international.
The minor, whatever demographic you are, players are spending less and less time in the minor leagues before they get to the majors. Do you think there's any takeaway from that, like seeing that happen now for multiple years? Is there any sort of shift in draft strategy that teams should be doing because of that? I'm sure there are some teams, we've very clearly seen teams like the Angels prioritize fast to the majors players, but I'm curious if, like, maybe you could take it in the opposite direction and say, hey, like, even the high school players these days, your ETA, you need to refit in your mind what a typical ETA is for certain players.
This goes back to something else that you and I have been talking about that we talked about last year, which is I do believe
drafting for now, need.
We are now at the point where I think not for the full draft, but if you are drafting at the top of the draft, the old adage of this is the Major League Baseball draft, you do not draft for need. Now, I would say if you draft for need rather than talent, you are doing something really stupid. But I do think that the old idea of draft these guys, but then you're not even giving thought to when they're going to arrive because you're just hoping they develop. And if it's 5 years, it's 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's out now, right? Like, to take the extreme example, another story put up yesterday, like, okay, he's a special case. But Connor Griffin, at this time 2 years ago, Connor Griffin was basically 2024. It's like, okay, this guy, no one at this point would have said, the Connor Griffin's family would not have said, yeah, I think he's going to be in spring training in 26 and we'll see if he makes the opening day roster. That didn't seem fathomable. Like, that seemed impossible.
Right. And that 24 class, Connor Griffin would have been in the phylum of player that's a really special athlete that you're going to need to take time with, be patient with. If you want someone who moves quickly, you have Charlie Condon, you have Travis Bazzano, you have JJ Witherell, you have Nick Kurtz. And to Nick Kurtz's credit, he kind of hammered home on that assessment of him, but you definitely would not have thought Connor Griffin, Bryce Rainer are in the sort of phylum of player who moves really, really quickly.
But so what I would say with that, though, is, and again, it doesn't mean everyone's going to move quick, but I do think, though, like, okay, this is what we said about last year's class. It doesn't mean, like, if you're the White Sox, obviously you're not just drafting talent, but the White Sox, while they are trying to improve, the White Sox are not something where they look at it right now and say, you know, I feel like that we are one wise pick away from contending, right? Yeah. Like, that's not, take the best talent, and when he arrives, right? Mm-hmm. But if I'm the Rays, if I'm the Pirates, you know, if I'm the Royals, right? These are teams, I think all three of those teams you would expect would be going into the 2027 season saying, we expect to contend for a playoff spot.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, not that you draft the guy to fit that, but when you say that you now can realistically think that there is the chance that a player you draft this July could, at least in the second half of the season, Nick Kurtz was faster than that. Cam Smith wasn't great, but he was faster than that. Zach Neto was faster than that. Like, we could go down a list of guys. Paul Skeens was faster than that. But if you're now saying it's a really good class, if we're taking a college guy, we think that he could make an impact by middle, second half of next season.
Yeah.
Well, then you should be able, if you're saying, like, we know that we're this position away, we don't, and we know they're probably not going to try to fill that in free agency, then I think it starts to become a little bit of a factor in your decision, at least, because you're not talking about, oh, that we can't project that. We don't know what our roster is going to look like 4 or 5 years from now. The college guys are moving way faster than that now.
Yeah. I would hope teams only ever use that as a decisive factor in their picks if it's a scenario where, and I think this happens more often than people think it does, there is a collection of players in the same tier where there's not really a significant difference in how the room is viewing the talent. So in that case, let's say you've got one high school pitcher and then you got a college hitter that you think are equivalent talents. You view them for the same bonus largely as a group. Maybe in that scenario, the ETA comes in. But I would even say, like, to push back further against it, like, the Pirates are maybe the most interesting team here. They're picking 6th overall in 2026. Like, how their draft philosophy or strategy changes will be really fascinating, because they seem to have been one of the few teams picking inside the top 10 that are just willing to take on more risk and more of an assumed timeline. And they've gotten great successes because of that. Like, because they are less scared off of Connor Griffin's risk factor, they took him at 9 and they're the beneficiaries. In 2025, they were one of the few teams who, leading up to the draft, we heard they're not afraid of taking Seth Hernandez. We had them linked to Seth Hernandez the entire time, talking to people who were, like, in the discussions for that pick. They were like, yeah, we just really wanted to shoot for upside here. And I think, like, in contrast to the Angels strategy, that has turned into franchise altering players for the Pirates. And I do think that, like, if the Pirates get to a point where you're like, we're ready to compete now, I would not want them to change that strategy, because what if you hit on another one?
I would say this, right? That's what I'm saying. It is a factor. It's a small one, right? Like, to take an example, if you were in the 2024 draft, right, we're just talking about, okay, Connor Griffin, let's take him out of this for a minute. Because, like I said, Connor Griffin's development is going to be, Connor Griffin is already moving right now into the Mike Trout category, where it's like, if you, Mike Trout was the perfect story, the one that was awful for everyone, because like, almost every team had a pick before Mike Trout.
And even so the Angels had a pick before Mike Trout.
So every team out there, the question was like, were you in on Trout? And to credit, some teams were like, no, we really weren't. But a lot of teams were like, you know, it came down. It was like Trout and this guy, and we went that way, and maybe we should have gone Trout. And then, like, wow, apparently that just kept happening all through the first round.
Right.
Connor Griffin's picked 9th, right? There's not nearly as many teams, but Connor Griffin is edging towards the direction of now where it's like, we'll be 5 years from now, there'll be questions like, wait, so you could have taken Connor Griffin? Like,
oh, that's already happening, JJ. We're already getting questions of people like, how did, like, the way it was phrased to me in a recent draft chat, which I'm not sure is like entirely fair to the industry, but people are asking, how did so many teams miss on Connor Griffin?
And
I don't think anyone missed on Connor Griffin. I think the player Connor Griffin was at the time was very obvious to everyone. The question was just, how can you know for a certainty that Connor Griffin is going to address the biggest question mark that has unlocked everything about the profile? That is the one question that you can only answer in hindsight. There are so many players who have had the same issue, or to even an even greater degree. I think it's too easy to spot check drafts after the fact and say, well, obviously they should have known about this player, because for every Connor Griffin, I think there are Benny Montgomerys, and I think there are Elijah Greens. There are players who had all the athleticism of the world, all the tools and the upside in the world, and that hit tool piece just didn't come, whether that is because of player development, whether that is because of something that the hitter does, whether that is the aptitude of the hitter. Sometimes it just doesn't work out. And I think there's quite literally every single draft you could go back to and say, why did every team miss on X player? So I don't know that there is a takeaway from the Connor Griffin story to say like, oh, what can scouts change in the future to not miss? You're just always going to miss, I think.
What I would say with that is that Connor Griffin, it's going to be that. It's going to be, everyone's gonna be like, well, how did the Guardians not take him one? But I would say, how did he not go two? How did he not go three? But what I would say with that is, to what you just said, there were real hit tool questions. And the ones that Connor Griffin himself has said, I had to go that offseason and rework my swing. Now, the aptitude to rework your swing and to go from your hit tool is your biggest question to I'm going to hit 330 while playing in low A, high A, and double A in my first pro year is one of those transformations.
While playing an elite shortstop.
Right. Where you go, and elite center field too, by the way.
Yeah.
And where you go, wow, okay, Mike Trout. Part of it is Mike Trout was in New Jersey and it was tough to evaluate a player in New Jersey. But there really are, there's kind of this, I would say that realistically, not with hindsight, but looking into it, going into it, his upper range was probably in that 4 or 5 range, because you did have.
Well, me and Ben brought this up on a recent podcast. I'm curious if you disagree. If the Pirates were picking one, there's no way Connor Griffin would have been the pick. I think they might be able to tell you that, but you would have to pass on Condon, Bazzana, Caglione, J.J. Weatherholt, Chase Burns and Hagen Smith, by the way. Who were like a different tier, maybe harder to compare, but like it wasn't as if the industry was like, oh, there are no good hitters here. We're going to pass on Connor Griffin because we don't think he can hit. There were a lot of really highly regarded hitters, some of which have panned out, some of whom have not yet. But I just don't think there's any universe where Connor Griffin was the first pick in that draft.
But what I would say though is that when you do kind of look back on it, it's like, to go back to your point that you asked me that I've really done a terrible job of answering quickly, which is, when you say the Pirates changing, I think that this is a factor, right? The way I would use it, if you go back to that 24 class and you say, okay, if you were a team picking at the top of that draft class and you're like, we think Bazzana, Weatherholt, and Nick Kurtz are our guys, right? Mm-hmm. There's these three college bats. We think they're all in the same tier. There's some level where you say, okay, well, what is it going to take to sign them? How much is that going to save Pharrell? But to take an extreme example of this, if you said, we think we're a playoff team. I mean, I would say normally people are going to lean to the middle infielders, right? Like if you think Weatherholt's a shortstop, you're going to be like, okay, let's take shortstop or first baseman. But I would say, to flip that though, if you said, we really believe Nick Kurtz is a dominating power hitter. Mm-hmm. And you know what we don't have right now? Like, okay, to take an example, the Pirates, right? If the Pirates were picking in a scenario and there's a Nick Kurtz like on the board next year at 6, maybe there will be, we'll see. And you're like, you know, that would actually really, we think that he's every bit as good as these other guys, but there's this slight advantage to it too, which is he will fix a problem that we have. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. I am not saying in any way, the Pirates should not look at it and say, what is our biggest need for 27? Well, we're taking that in the, you know, with our pick. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that. Whereas I would say that 10 years ago, you wouldn't even consider the possibility of that. I am saying now, to take another version of it, if you take the shortstop, who cares? If you take shortstop and if you can't play shortstop, you move them, right? Mm-hmm. But for instance, if the Orioles right now, they're not picking at the top, but if they were, and you said, hey, they've got multiple guys on their board and they're going to take this fast-moving college outfielder, my question to that would be, okay. And your plan to play that player is what? You know, but again, I know Taylor Ward's going to be, you know, there's a 1-year deal and all this. Tyler O'Neill will, but my point being, if you're already jammed up at a position and it's a position where, well, we're drafting a left-handed throwing, you know, outfielder, and you're like, well, he's a corner outfielder and we got four of those.
Yeah.
I do think that now you have to look at it at least a little bit more because you don't have that, oh, it'll work its way out.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that this study kind of showed, the thing that jumps out about it is if you draft a college guy, what's changed is partly is reorganization of the minors. If you draft a college guy, he's not going to play in the complex and he's probably not going to play in low A.
It's only a very little sample of like maybe right after you sign, but your first full season, it's high A and double A, right?
So you're going to start in high A probably when your first full season. And if you have a good start, you're going to then bump to double A. Well, the point of this is if you're in AAA to start the following season, and that means that you are ready for the call at any moment. And we've seen this now with, again, it's not just one player. It's Wyatt Langford as well. There's a lot of these guys now, a number of these players, I should say at least. But if that's the case, you at least have to start thinking, okay, what we don't want to do is if we're really, really full at one position where we don't want to just be stacking up guys at AAA. And my point of that is that they stack up much quicker now than they would have where 5, 10 years ago, it had been like 10 years ago, it had been like, well, that's not really a problem. Going to go to short season ball his first year when he's drafted. We'll send him to low A. He'll get to high A for the second half of his first full season, double A the following year, maybe gets to AAA at the end of the year, and then he gets to AAA. That's far enough out that you're not having to think of these things. That's 3 years down the road. Who knows what's going to happen 3 years down the road. But if you're talking that it's, in a lot of these cases, like we just talked about, that class, right? Kurtz is up. I would expect that Condon, that Weatherholt, that Bazana will all be in AAA to start the season. Like, that's the 2024. Connor Griffin is either going to be in AAA or in the majors. That's the 2024 draft class. And my point being is if you draft those guys high in 24, you have to have an idea of where they're going to fit on your AAA roster in 20 and the big leagues in 26. That's a much faster timetable we used to have.
Yeah, no, that all makes sense. I think a lot of teams have probably already started drafting with kind of some of these ideas in mind. It's why you see so many teams have super college heavy drafts in the first place. I think maybe even to the point where some teams can zig while everyone else is zagging and maybe find just more explosive talent that's being passed on because of some of these timeline considerations.
And Ben wrote that great piece about the Brewers. And like, I mean, I just got done recording an Orioles deep dive, and that was, you know, we're talking about Nate George. And like, there are talents to be found later on because opportunities are created. But at the flip side of that is, like, when you look at, we said this is a good high school class, but we have three high school players currently in the top 10, and we have three high school players currently in the top 14 of this class right now.
Yep.
I mean, again, we do think that college guys are going to, there's going to be a lot of college guys who go off the board in the top 15 picks.
Okay, here's a question I have for you that's more specific to the 2026 class, JJ, after having some kind of macro level strategic talk. Brock Chulowski obviously won one. If you're picking two, who most excites you after Brock Chulowski? This is a conversation that I've been having with a lot of people in recent days. Me and Ben talked about number three in particular because we both have Brock Chulowski. We've got Grady Emerson, like our board has. And then, so maybe the question is, if you also think Grady two, who's number three?
I would say three because right now, Grady Emerson, if you're picking two, I don't feel like that you're going to, I know that you're not going to get Rock, but if you're the Rays and you get Grady Emerson at two, I don't think that you're shaking your head and going, oh.
I think in another draft class, Grady Emerson is a perfectly legitimate 1-1. I think if he was eligible a year ago, he probably would have gone over Eli Willett's 1-1.
After that, that's where it gets really interesting. And that's where, to an extent you said, like, we want to be cautious. We don't want to overdo it. We're in non-conference play and all that. Everything you say about that with, okay, we think Rock's one. Justin LeBron, I would say you could multiply everything that you just said there by about 20.
Let's go. I love this because I thought you were definitely going to be going in the Jackson Flora pitching direction. And the fact that you said Justin LeBron makes me very excited. That's the player that both me and Ben centered on as well. We're infatuated with the upside, but maybe you're about to say, and I wouldn't take him.
And I'm saying that's the guy who I need. I want the totality of the season to tell 100%.
Yeah, I think his conference slate is maybe the most important of anyone in this top 15 ranges.
Okay, like perfect example of this. Drew Burris, I expect Drew Burris to have a monster year, but we can say this for Drew Burris. If Drew Burris just has a fine year, kind of like J.J. Weatherholt was injured, like J.J. Weatherholt was the batting champ as a sophomore and then had the hamstring injury and missed a lot of his junior year. But at the end of the day, you're like, do you think J.J. Weatherholt's going to hit? It's like, well, when is he ever not?
Right.
I think Drew Burris is going to hit. I don't have a whole lot of question about that. Now, every other tool, like I would say, advantage might be Justin LeBron. So what I want to know is give me more time to see how the contact.
JJ, how dare you? Your answer is nuanced and rational. I want this to play itself out. You have to pick now.
No, but what I was going to say with that is though, that's where I do think that three is kind of a great. Again, I want to be one. I want to pick one. I want to just say. Mm-hmm. I don't have a tough decision to make. I just say,
yeah, for all the White Sox fans who were mad a year ago that they were locked out of a lottery pick, you're very excited now that you were locked out of a lottery pick.
I made a joke with I've noticed, like, I follow Future Sox, you know, White Sox, you know, site, and their social media
is a rock.
They post as much rock stuff right now as they do.
Like, well, it's to the point now where, like, regardless of what happened, almost regardless of what happened, maybe if, like, Rock says he hates baseball and retires, they wouldn't feel this way. But, like, any other universe, if Rock is not the pick, there are going to be a lot of disappointed White Sox fans.
But what I would say is what's interesting about this when you look at it is, again, we could see, like, Jackson Flora, like, I do think that there are multiple pitchers here who absolutely could work themselves into that discussion. Mm-hmm. But we also don't have a ton of them who've done it so far. Like, I feel like
Jackson Flora is kind of the one that's put his foot forward and both improved and also performed. Like, Cam Flukie's first game looked every bit what I expected Cam Flukie to be. Yeah, he let up back-to-back home runs, but other than that, it was same stuff. He carved good strikes, but now he's injured, so that's a question mark. How much time is he going to miss? What's he going to look like when he gets back? And I think our third pitching candidate in the top 10 here, Liam Peterson, has actually not looked too great.
Oh,
the first 2 weeks, I wrote about this on the site. You can read about it if you want, but his big question is, how is the strike throwing going to look? He needs to continue taking strides, and at least in the first two starts, very early, he's regressed in that category. I just need him to throw the ball over the plate more, so... Yeah, I feel like if you're not taking Flora 3, you're not taking a pitcher really at all at 3 at this stage.
I'd pose it this way. You just said, like, if Grady Emerson was in last year's class, he'd go 1-1.
Right.
If Dax Whitney was in this year's class, I think
he's number 2 in the class, no doubt. It's a Rock Chulowski and Dax Whitney show. There's Dax Whitney might be, I said this on Future Projection, Dax Whitney is probably the best pitcher since Paul Skeens in the draft, and I don't know that that's particularly crazy to say.
I my fear of him is just please stay healthy and keep.
Yeah, with every pitcher. Yeah. Yeah. It's absurd what he's doing. So, but you don't get Dax.
But what I would say is like, we have had some discouraging news already, right? Like Tyler Bell. I mean, I know Tyler Bell's kind of in that mid tier of the first round range.
Right.
But that's a college shortstop who has pedigree. That was a second round pick out of high school who is going to miss significant time. We just talked about Cam Flukie is missing significant time. I would say that Liam Peterson hasn't been great. I think that there are real concerns, like, okay, I'm going to be fascinated. If I said Justin LeBron, same thing with Derek Curiel, where it's like, I know he's good. I want to see, like, I want the season to show how much impact he can create.
Right.
I think Ace Reese can really hit. I want to know where he's going to play. Like there's a lot of guys. I feel like even in the top half of the first round candidates right now, where you're like, okay, this guy could be good, but I feel like partly also because this class is pretty deep. You wrote about like Eric Booth recently. And it's like, again, that's another guy. Eric Booth Jr. is another guy who are like, let's see the totality of the season play out kind of guy. But like, I do feel like that the outfielders in the middle of the teens on our rankings right now. Okay, let's see where they go. I feel like that this has this top tier where it's like Rock has like the concrete set, right? Like,
yep.
The worst scenario of a healthy Rock Chulowski, like, is like that he's going to rank one, probably. There's a slight chance of two. And I think three is like his floor of where a healthy Rock Chulowski, I can't imagine how he get to three, to be honest.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to envision scenarios.
I would say that Grady Emerson, a healthy Grady Emerson, he might fall because a college guy really emerges and all, like, he could fall to three, four.
Right.
But he's not falling out of the top five. He's done enough already that healthy. Again, this is all healthy for all these guys. Nothing off the field. But assuming just standard, like, there's nothing that comes up. Those guys aren't moving far.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, though, by the time you get to like five to 15 on this list, I feel like could have a lot of movement. Partly because there are questions on a lot of those guys, but partly because there's also a lot of guys who could move up into that range too.
I agree. And even guys like at 17 and 18, the college outfielders, AJ Gracia at Virginia and Sawyer Strassnyder at TCU, those are guys that we've had inside the top 10 at various points. But we moved them down preseason because of some of their questions. And I think both of them, and maybe even especially Gracia, are already addressing some of their questions. Like, AJ Gracia's hit power combination is massively exciting. He's gotten aggressive in the most beneficial way, I think, for his profile. So if he maintains that through conference play, that's a bat that could easily fit inside the top five, to my mind. So there's just a lot of hitters and profiles that with strong seasons could quite easily get into this mix as we get closer to the draft.
The other thing I would say, though, is, like, you know, kind of along those lines, is we absolutely, like, if you just use, I love that we have the data to kind of go back and look at, like, how the class evolves year by year, right?
And if year for each class, we have, it should be every basically ranking in season, we have that internally. I don't know if there's a way to see that on the site, but we have it at least.
And probably that's something that's worth building out at some point. But, like, I would say, and again, I think that us having this conversation has already led me. I know a study I'm doing now. I have a hypothesis, and now I need to dive into it. But what I was going to say is like, okay, this time last year, Liam Doyle was basically doing everything other than setting himself on fire to demonstrate that, hey, pay attention to me. And again, this was week two. It was very early in that process. But what I'm saying is there's going to be guys who absolutely, and by the way, at this point last year, we were already starting to write Jace Laviolette. I know he was preseason one, but
wasn't looking great. Yeah.
The whole point I'm trying to say with that is that there are guys like Gage Wood who seemingly come almost out of nowhere into the first round, you know, like far off of the top first round into the first round.
Yep.
But there is more movement in this than I think a lot of times, you know, the challenge that you have to do it more than any of us for us. But the challenge we're always trying to do here is both accurately reflect the movement without overreacting.
Yep.
And I would say, though, if you're listening to this, if you sometimes get upset of how we're changing guys, just know that, again, I'm not saying we have 100% hit rate on this, but we heard from a lot of people last year, early in the year, who are like, you're way overreacting on Jace Laviolette. And we weren't. I just want to lay out.
Yeah.
You weren't writing about that because you went to a game and said,
I've never once, like, basically seen performance numbers and had that reaction. The reaction is almost entirely driven because scouts say, hey, the swing looks different. The athleticism is backed up. There are real questions here. We all have him lower because of that. I'd say the exact, a great case of how this is not the case is Nick Kurtz his year. The first few weeks of Nick Kurtz's season, his numbers were not good, but his ABs were rock solid. He was hitting the ball really hard. He was just getting unlucky balls in play. Like, the process involved in Nick Kurtz's early season ABs when his numbers did not look exceptional were totally in line with what he was as a hitter. And I think that's maybe the best look I've had at a person where the performance was uninspiring, but I was super confident in the hitting ingredients. But to your point, I am also not personally going in there and saying, this is my evaluation. I'm trying to collect as much feedback as I can from the industry to drive these moves.
But what I would say is, and this is not a knock on the draftniks and all who subscribe to us and read us, and those who just followed on social media know, if we're not telling you stuff that sometimes you think is a little hasty, then we're not doing our jobs right. Because I watch this. I love the NFL draft. I pay attention to the NFL draft. And I've actually now, like, because I get to work in this and knowing kind of how it operates, like, I now have the fun of being, like, with a buddy of mine, and I'll get to, like, late in the season, in the NFL season, because obviously their schedule is very different. Like, the season ends, and then they have all the evaluations and the combine, and then they pick, then they draft, like, 6 months after the season's over, 4 months after the season's over, I should say, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to baseball, where it's like the season ends and it's like, okay, we're drafting. You know, but, and I say to him, it's like, I remember a couple years ago, it's like, I know that Jaden Daniels isn't showing up as being in consensus top 30 right now. I promise you that guy would go in the top five picks. But just knowing how it works, it's like the way that industry on the NFL draft works on the media side mm-hmm. is the, because the season ends and then you have all this time, the in-season rankings don't really always reflect everything. No one can watch every player who's a possible first round pick. No one's talking to scouts for every player. And so you understandably, you're kind of slow. And then you get the season's over. Everyone watches the tape. It's like, oh, this is the top of the first round pick. And then the changes make.
Yeah.
We're trying to do this in baseball where we hear it. Like, you do hear where it's like, here's what I'm concerned about. Here's what you got to watch. And we do, like, sometimes we see it. And then that leads us to ask questions too, where it's like, have you seen this guy? You know, like, you see it, and then you're like, okay, now I've got to go get more reporting on it. But, and I would say that that's where what's trickiest about this, and what's hard, but we got to do, that's where talking to a lot of scouts really matters, is it's a little easier on the college side, because the other part of that piece that went up at yesterday at Baseball America about players moving faster is now on the evaluative side, there's better information too from a data standpoint, which, mm-hmm. and what I mean by that is Nick Kurtz is a perfect example of this, right? In the story, I used Roman Anthony. Roman Anthony was promoted from low A to high A, and he was hitting 226, 376, 316. He had one of the worst batting averages and slugging percentages of anyone in low A at the time he was promoted.
Right.
And the Red Sox promoted him because 42 games, and they're looking at it and they're saying, the underlying, what he's actually doing is not, the stats haven't caught up to it yet. He is right. Unlucky. Nick Kurtz, like you said, in that scenario was unlucky. But the thing about that is, if you kind of now go to, and again, this doesn't mean that results don't matter at all, but if you go to a more context neutral approach, right? Mm-hmm. Where you say, is he swinging at the right pitches? Is he taking the pitches he should take? When he does, is he making contact in the zone? When he does, is he hitting the ball hard? Whether a guy makes a diving catch in right field or right. it goes for a triple or a double doesn't really change whether it was a good, you know, a good swing, yep. a good process. It does change a good result, right?
Right.
And that, I would say the key thing about that is that you can look at quicker. Right.
Yeah.
Because agreed. Instead of it being that you got unlucky and you ran into a good defense that stole three hits from you and it takes you a month to catch up for that. If you looking at it at a pitch by pitch basis, there's a bigger picture and it's a little bit less context dependent. But on the high school side, you don't have that same. That all happened in the summer. On the high school side, you're now having to evaluate it much less on that kind of pitch by pitch. You're also facing guys who aren't giving you that same level of right. comfort of what you're facing. And that's where it gets more challenging, I think, too, is reflecting, talking to enough people to know which high school guys are moving up and down, which is a lot more based on, I would say, kind of a little bit more, you know, traditional than
yeah.
where we now have this other information at the college side.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good look into just kind of the process that we go through here when building the board, and kind of gets me excited to continue doing it, actually. So I think that's probably going to wrap it for today, JJ. Any other topics we didn't get to that you want to hit on? I feel like we've hit on some players, we've hit on some strategy, we've hit on some draft board building thoughts. So, it's been a fun convo.
So, okay, I've got one, right? Okay. we just had, you know, we every year we have some reclassifications. You mentioned Steel Hall, right?
Yep.
We have some this year. We have some every year, right? What's interesting about Connor Griffin, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. What's interesting about that to me is I wonder, and again, this would be a fun study at some point, the differences in the evaluations based on the timing of the reclassification. And what I mean by that is that I know that there are times where there's kind of an indication coming, but to go back to the earlier point that we were talking about, right? Which is we said, like, you don't have the full story. For a player who reclassifies, like, I would say, let's say coming out of their junior season, so you know the whole summer,
right?
And then you know the whole season. I feel like you got a little bit more of that full story than you do for a player who started, you know, like you thought was going to be in that following class, and then after the showcases mm-hmm. are over,
right?
And in, you know, like you're leading into the season, you find out. Mm-hmm. I do wonder if those are a tougher evaluations from a standpoint of, like, even mm-hmm. if you have been, again, a good area scout is keeping tabs on next year's class and the class after that and all that.
Yeah.
But you can't, there's only so many hours in the day. You can't bear down as much on a guy that you think you've got another year. And then if you find out that you don't, I wonder right. what you thought.
I tend to agree. I mean, I think that just there are going to be some teams whose process works differently and is more reliant on those area scouts really getting in the weeds and doing homework on players in future years. And I think those teams are going to benefit from going as deep as they do, and also putting themselves in a position to act on information that is maybe more heavily driven from area scout feedback. Like, there are some teams that even if their area scout was doing all that legwork, if their national guys didn't get to see those looks the summer before, there would be a lot more hesitance in pulling the trigger on draft day for someone who reclassified during the spring. So maybe their heavy hitters didn't really see players like Jared Greinlinger, who's a recent reclassification, Will Brick, a catcher in this year's class, who reclassified after the showcase. Those are two players this year who throughout the summer showcase period were presumed to be 2027 players. Like, Logan Schmidt is maybe the opposite. He's a reclass who reclassified prior to the summer, so everyone was bearing down on him and focused on him throughout that cycle. So I tend to think that, like, if you are going to reclassify, it is more beneficial for you to do it earlier. At the same time, like, maybe some of it is, hey, like, I just performed really well, I'm going to be young for the class, like, I play at a powerhouse program, people have seen me, and Jared Greinlinger certainly does play at a powerhouse program at Huntington Beach. His brother was also a prominent prospect a year ago. So maybe you could say that he's a player who is a little bit of an exception because enough people have seen him. But I tend to agree generally with you that you want to be seen as much as you can by the industry as a whole and when they're focused on you for the current year draft class. But that hasn't stopped some prominent reclassification players from going in good spots in the past. And
but I wouldn't expect also,
for this year to change either.
The other thing that stands out is I do think the way that teams model, like, okay, so like if we're going, like if someone's wondering, well, okay, well, obviously 1-1, Eli Willits, you mm-hmm. know, like, okay, Cruz Schoolcraft, Steel Hall. So like that's three very prominent picks from last year's class. Year before that, Connor Griffin, Cam Caminiti. Like,
there's a handful. Quentin Young also year,
last
yeah.
year too. But yeah. what I'm saying with this though is I'm throwing out that theory, but then I'll just point out there are a lot of players who are finding it. Like, I get it though that for
hitters, especially for the age thing.
If you're a hitter, and all of a sudden you're now going to be one of the youngest players. Like, mm-hmm. it does work for Connor Griffin. It's like, it's funny because we talk about Connor Griffin, and then I had people ask me, like, because there was another piece about how Connor Griffin, do check it out at baseballamerica.com, that Connor Griffin, if he makes open day roster, pretty much will fit in a group of experience, age, and, you know, minor league experience and age with four players the last 40 years. And those four players are Ken Griffey Jr., Alex Rodriguez, Bryce Harper, and Juan Soto, which mm-hmm. good group. The thing of that is someone's like, well, what about Kevin McGonigal? And it's like, Connor Griffin, even though he's one class after, but Connor Griffin is 19, getting ready to turn 20, and Kevin McGonigal is 21 and a half because Kevin McGonigal didn't reclassify. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if Connor Griffin is the player that we think he is, I'm not joking when I say reclassifying for him could earn him in free agency an additional $100 million. Because if he doesn't sign an extension and he does arrive this year, as we expect, 6 years from now gets him to, he'll be basically one of the youngest free agents that we've seen. If you wonder why Juan Soto made so much money, Juan Soto is the last teenage hitter to debut in the big leagues. If you do that, you then hit free agency at an age where it's like, oh,
yeah,
you have 5 years of your prime still ahead of you.
Exactly.
That gets you paid so much more than the guy who's the college hitter who hits free agency at 29. And it's like, well, you've been good. Hopefully you can hang on to it for a while, but it's not the same thing. It's like, oh, you're 25. You're going to be 26 for this.
Yeah. Great. This is also why signing out of high school can be a pretty good idea at times. I know everyone is all about the go to college for a lot of kids. And again, Bobby Witt Jr., that's not a player that I want to see playing in college baseball. I'm sorry. He's too good. I think pro teams should be incentivized to get the elite talents into pro ball. And I think for a lot of the elite high school talents, like if you're ready to go compete every day and have baseball be your job, it's a great route.
I will say this, you know, like there's been talk about like, what is the MLB's goals, you know, the owner's goals, the player association goals in negotiations. If there ever is a moment where high school players, I know that there's been an emphasis on pushing more players to college. There's a reduction in the number of draft rounds. There's the elimination of the advanced rookie in the short season leagues, all that, right? That's one thing. If you're the MLBPA, I know that the salary cap is kind of their biggest, like we can't let that happen. If you're the MLBPA and you ever allow like the banning of signing high school, drafting high school players, you're taking literally on the player side, hundreds of millions of dollars out of it. Because if you look at the highest paid players in the game, there are exceptions. Aaron Judge has been a very fascinating career development, but especially on the hitter side, they're generally
high school and Latin
because
or international.
Yeah. Yep. Because if you hit the big leagues at 19, 20, 21, you hit free agency at the get paid age. And I don't care how good a college player you are and how fast you move, the best you're going to do is 21 to 22. And a lot of cases, most cases, 23. 23 plus six means you're at the tail end of your peak time. 19 or 20 plus six puts you right in the middle of your peak time.
Absolutely. Okay, good way to close that one out, JJ. It's been a fun hour of draft talk with you. Maybe we'll have to pull you on the draft show more often throughout the spring. Yeah, always love breaking it down. So definitely check out the site if you missed out on any of the draft coverage we had over the past 2 weeks. It's going to be a heavy week next week as well. I'm back out in Texas alongside college writer Jacob Rudner. We got a great slate of games and a lot of talented high school players I'll be able to see there as well. So plenty more coming on the draft front on the website, on our podcasts, on the YouTube channel for Hot Sheet, all the avenues that you guys can get the content. Really appreciate you supporting BA and letting us do this work. So for JJ, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.